So it's my great pleasure to introduce Padmavajra, our special guest today. Padmavajra has inspired many, many people over the years. And I'll just touch on a few of his many inspiring qualities. For one thing, he's very inspiring in terms of commitment. He got involved at a very young age, age 17,
correct,
and ordained at age 19. And from, you know, very early on, he's just thrown himself into dedication to the Dharma, the Buddha, and the Sangha, and to Tri Ratna and to his teacher, Sangharakshita. And through that commitment, it just seems like so many fruits and riches have come out over the years. So many inspiring talks, very, very heart-connected, great clarity about the Dharma and depth around the Dharma. So many personal inspirations through... He's been chair of Padmaloka. He's overall men's mitra convener.
For Europe
and the UK, public preceptor. And he's also was very involved here in Croydon. So I think, as far as what I've known about Padmavajra, every phase of his life has just been a complete commitment and put in tremendous energy for the good into whatever he does. And I'm very, very delighted to welcome you here today.
Thank you very much, Amara Pushpa. Thank you. I'm very, very happy to be here in Croydon again. Apparently it was only a year and a half ago I was last here.
Yeah, maybe 2 years.
Maybe
right?
2 years.
Yeah.
Amara Pushpa is... you all know how delightful Amara Pushpa is. Amara Pushpa, although she's a flower, she's also a flower of the deathless. She's also very determined, and she has this wonderful ability to sort of charm me quite firmly into driving me to do things. And, I can't say no to Amara Pushpa. And a while ago I promised to come again to Croydon, and I tend to do things rather spontaneously these days. Most of my diary is sort of filled and planned for the year ahead, but if I'm noticing that there are some gaps and I sort of fancy doing something, I suggest I do it. So it wasn't that long ago that I suggested I come and do something, and I much prefer that sort of spontaneous way of doing things. If I had my way, it would all be spontaneous. I mean, that, you know, I could just call somebody up and say, hey, do you fancy me giving a talk next week? And everybody said yes, but it doesn't seem to work like that, unfortunately. But I've been really looking forward to coming. I've been on a two-week meditation retreat at Papaloka on the Bodhicitta, the urge to enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, and we were doing a lot of metta bhavana, a lot of devotional practice, a lot of karuna bhavana, developing compassion, and a lot of meditation on the bodhicitta, the generation of the bodhicitta practice. And very strong, very demanding practice involving all sorts of dimensions to it. It was very, very quiet at Padmaloka. And very well led by Satyaraja, who also used to be involved in the Croydon Centre. And your president was on the retreat as well, Sangadeva. And I find that very, very interesting that there's actually a lot of very, very senior and experienced and inspired order members who've trained in Croydon, who've had their training in Croydon. I live with Dharmadeepa, who... he's on the ordination team, and he, of course, has a long association with Croydon. And we've, at various times when friends from Croydon have sat down, we've gone through the number of very, very senior order members taking quite weighty responsibility, and how they came to the Dharma through the Croydon Buddhist Centre. There's a lot of us. I mean, I had an association with the Dharma before I came to Croydon, but my time here was very, very formative. It was a very, very strong time, and, you know, the difficulties that we lived through in the 80s and so on have been well rehearsed, you know, the sort of failures that we made, myself included. But I was thinking on what was coming up on my retreat, on this bodhicitta retreat, just spontaneous memories that were coming up, was actually remembering teaching the Dharma in this very room. And it's wonderful to see how it's been you know, completely remade, although it's still got its particular character, because it had a very particular character with its corrugated iron, which I rather liked. And I was saying earlier that it was very, very hot in the summer and very cold in the winter, this room. But actually, I've got a lot of happy memories of communicating the Dharma in this space, and, you know, the garden out there, you know, especially in the summertime, going out there on warm evenings. You know, we'd have very big classes, and, you know, there'd be this sort of overspill outside. And in many ways, if you forgive the phrase, I sort of learnt my trade as a Dharma teacher, if you like, here. I did an enormous amount of courses and classes and talks. Paparaja, who was the chairman, he didn't like being out front. He didn't like teaching particularly, but he wanted. He had this sort of mania, and it was a mania sometimes, for excellence. But there was also something very good about that. So he wanted his best people, the best people, to do the teaching. And I was the most experienced person, so I did a lot of courses and classes here. And you know, it's very you know, there are a number of people who first encountered the Dharma here who I taught, first taught meditation. And I was reflecting that I'm so glad that the Croydon Buddhist Centre has carried on here, you know, through all sorts of ups and downs. I came to Croydon quite early this morning from London, because I just wanted to look around at the place. I wanted to kind of, you know, make my acquaintance again with the local deities, as it were, walking down from the station up the... it wasn't a pedestrian area when I was here. It was a main road, and walking up Surrey Street Market and, you know, checking out the multi-storey car park and all that. So I just wanted to just tune in. And I feel very, very glad that we still have a centre here. Croydon is exactly the kind of town where we need to have a Buddhist centre. We really need to have a Buddhist centre in these urban environments. You know, I live out in a tiny little village in South Norfolk, and it's great for a retreat centre, but it's not the kind of place where you're going to, you know, you're going to meet lots of people to teach the Dharma. You need centres in places like Croydon, where there are a lot of people about, which will draw on a lot of people, and which is a sort of source of light, if you like, within an urban environment. We used to feel that very strongly. In fact, we were very, very proud of that when, back in the 80s, when we were here, when we had the restaurant and the art centre and the whole thing of practising the Dharma, living the Dharma in an urban environment. It was a big inspiration for us. The fact that we were right next to a multi-storey car park with a snooker hall underneath it, which I gather is still there, near a flyover. Yes, yes. You know, this is where this. There's a poetry in that, a gritty kind of poetry in that. You need to practice the Dharma in such places and communicate the Dharma in such places. So I'm really glad. I'm really glad that you've had the confidence and faith and inspiration to, you know, renew the centre and to have classes here. And, well, I really hope that will just go on and on and on and on, because there's a venerable lineage, you know, that this centre comes out of. Yeah, so I'm very, very glad to be here. And it's curious, one of the things I was reflecting on during this Bodhicitta retreat, because you do this particular practice, which some of you might have heard of, called Tonglen, sending and receiving. You have to set up the conditions in which to do it properly. You have to have a vivid sense of the inspiration of the bodhicitta, the heart of enlightenment. You need to have a strong feeling for that, deep feeling for that, and real reflection on the nature of things. But in the practice, you visualize, you imagine the sufferings of others, particular people, the whole world with its deep sufferings. You imagine that as a black cloud, black smoke, and on your in-breath you take it into the brightness of the bodhicitta as much as you can be in touch with it, and that black smoke of suffering is transformed by that consciousness, by that mind, which isn't really yours, it's something you've opened up to. And on the out-breath you imagine white light or nectar or wonderful things just pouring down on others, alleviating their suffering. You're imagining that they're changing through, you know, your in and out breath. It's a very, very powerful practice, and has a strong sort of purification aspect. And I was reflecting on my life. Yes, I did encounter the Dharma at quite a young age, but it hasn't been an easy path, and you know, there's still lots and lots to purify. And one of the things I was, just very glad to be reflecting on coming here was speaking in a place where I did do really good things, but I also made quite a few mistakes. And a sort of sense of, well, you can purify that. You can purify your life through, in a way, going to places where you've been before and really doing well there, really be in communication with people in the context of the bodhicitta, meet with them in the Dharma completely positively. So I've been looking forward to this very much in order to communicate the Dharma well, hopefully. And of course it involves you listening well as well as me communicating well. It's a two-way process. And Vijaya Shri, who was very pleased I was coming, an old friend from Croydon days. I remember when Vijaya Shri first came along to Aryatara long, long ago when we had classes there. She wrote to me and said, you're having this series on freedom. But she added in her email to me that she's particularly concerned about freedom from polarisation. The modern world seems to be, well, the world has always been polarised, people polarised, it's what human beings do. But we seem to be in a particularly polarised and conflicted kind of environment these days. It's one of the things that is just so noticeable. It's almost sort of celebrated by, you know, some of our, you know, our... you know, our leaders, so-called leaders, and so on. People almost celebrating, you know, just being in conflict and just being rude to one another. Everything seems to be politicised, absolutely everything. But by politicised, I mean turning into camps, and it's almost as if, you know, people want to put you into a camp, you know, that if you don't subscribe to their point of view, well then you must be of the left, or you must be of the right, and you must be of the this, and you must be of the that. And I think Buddhists, if you're a serious Buddhist, you have to completely transcend that polarisation. Really not be involved in that kind of polarising attitude. It was one of the things I've been a little bit concerned about with recently, where good friends of mine, seem to be getting into polarised positions about, you know, various things, the environment, Brexit, gender, this, that, the other, and so on and so forth. And there's a kind of heat that comes into it, a heat and an aggression, obviously fuelled a lot by the ease with which one can talk rubbish on the internet without any kind, which you would surely you would never talk like that to somebody if you were with them. Well, hopefully one wouldn't. But this polarising is just really horrible and completely antithetical to the Dharma and to the spiritual community. We must distance ourselves from it. And I was reflecting actually on a wonderful lecture that Bhante gave here, Buddhism, World Peace and Nuclear War, 1984, Pauline reminded me it was. I think it was 1984. I was at that lecture. I remember we were doing a series at the Art Centre on non-violence, I think, and Padma Raja managed to entreat Bhante to give this lecture, which he also gave in central London. It's a very, very hot evening, I remember. We had all sorts of fans on and so on. And it's a really important lecture, because at that time, 1980s, you had nuclear proliferation. You know, there really was a fear that there'd be, you know, complete catastrophe. And, you know, he wanted to talk about this topic. And one of the things he talks about is non-polarisation. He doesn't use that language, but coming into communication with one another. And one of the things he says, which really struck me, was that be very careful, if you're a Buddhist, getting involved with other groups who are for world peace and nuclear disarmament, but being very careful how you do that, because they might have other agendas. He said that the movement for world peace must not be hijacked. And a Buddhist perspective on that is going to be very, very different. And I think that applies to everything, because there is this strong tendency to politicise, to polarise, to dogmatise. There is a Buddhist perspective on all of the kind of world problems that we have. But we shouldn't assume that we know it just because we know a little bit about Buddhism. We've got to go very, very deep to find what the uniquely Buddhist perspective is, and make sure that the perspectives that we've taken hold of, the opinions that we're so sure of, are they actually really in tune with the Dharma, in tune with what the Buddha actually says. So I think there's a whole topic there, and it does mean freeing ourselves internally, first of all. This word freedom is so loaded, isn't it? Again, that's another big topic, this topic of freedom, and we tend to bring all sorts of assumptions to the notion of freedom in the modern world, which don't necessarily have anything to do with the Buddha's vision of freedom. They don't necessarily have anything to do with it whatsoever. The notion of vimukti or vimoksha, which are the terms for freedom, liberation, that the Buddha has, that Buddhist tradition has, are actually very mysterious. I remember studying with Bhante his lecture, The Taste of Freedom. And we were sitting there talking about the nature of vimukti, the nature of freedom. And he was getting quite old, and he wasn't seeing properly. And we tended, in this particular group, we were sort of throwing a lot of questions at him. A lot of the time he was just sitting there and kind of commenting. And at a certain point he said, yes, it's very difficult to understand what the Buddha means by freedom. I think we probably ought to just sit and contemplate for quite some time before we venture into that topic. And he just paused, and it was as if he was starting to meditate on the nature of vimukti. And we were all sort of sitting there feeling slightly weird. But, you know, I wish we'd had the courage to sort of enter more deeply into that contemplation, because, of course, vimukti is synonymous with nirvana. It's synonymous with enlightenment in its ultimate sense. It's complete freedom, for a start, from all negative affectivity, all negative emotion. You know, if we want to have any discussion about freedom and freedoms and being free to do something, we have to reject entirely greed and hatred, resentment, jealousy, conceit, all those things. They have no place in liberation. If we're entering into a discussion about something and there's any of that negative affectivity, we are not free. We are not going to be free from polarisation. If we want to be confident in freedom and non-polarisation, freedom from polarisation, we have to dwell in what are called the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes, the immeasurables, love, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. They collectively are called the Chitta Vimoksha, the liberation of the heart, the liberation of the mind. You're completely free from that. The Buddha is completely free from that. And then, of course, there's liberation from all wrong, partial, false views, distortions, distorted pictures of reality. The Buddha is completely liberated from that. There's no confusion, no delusion. There's a clear seeing of the way things are. That's called the liberation through wisdom, the prajna vimoksha, the liberation of wisdom. So both of these need to be there. So if we're getting into any discussions about, you know, the things we're particularly concerned about in life, whether it's in social life, political life, or in personal life, we need to do some work. We need to do some work on purifying our mind of negative emotion and purifying our mind of delusion. It's only then that we can really have deep discussion. It might even be that we use the discussion as a way of bringing about that freedom, that liberation. But we have to be really honest, you know, with ourselves in doing this. And the Buddha's enlightenment in some of the oldest texts is characterized as the bliss of liberation, the vimokkha sukha, or the sukha vimokkha, the bliss of liberation. It says after the Buddha has gained Bodhi, gained awakening, enlightenment beneath the Bodhi tree, he sits for different periods of 7 days without moving. Which means 7 is a magic number in ancient Indian tradition, so he's really out of time. But he sits in the bliss of liberation. He's just enjoying that freedom, just that completely endless state of the Bodhi mind, the Bodhicitta, as it's called in later Buddhist tradition. And it's really pleasurable. It's really enjoyable. This is very, very important that we also realise that the enlightened state is a state of bliss, absolute, overwhelming ecstasy. Nirvana paramam sukham, the Buddha says. Nirvana is the supreme bliss. It's not just freedom from negative emotion, freedom from delusion. It's this state of great bliss, great enjoyment and pleasure. So, yes, I wanted to sort of bring that in sort of try to evoke, if you like, this business of freedom and liberation, and in relation to this whole topic of polarization. But I also want to try to move into that, talking about that perhaps a little bit more, as it were, practically, in terms of the way a sangha, a spiritual community, conducts itself. And this here in Croydon, you have a sangha. This class is a sangha. We are a spiritual community at this moment, a particular configuration of the Sangha in Croydon. And of course the centre is run by order members and mitras and friends, and the way it works and operates is it's a spiritual community. It's to do with, and a spiritual community of course is to do with the liberation of the individuals within it. It also has an altruistic dimension. That's why we have a centre. It's reaching out to others, coming in off the street or responding to an advert or something like that. So there's that element of reaching out to people, to offer to people the way to this liberation. So it's very important that the way we are together has that quality of freedom and liberation about it. We need to exemplify that, yes, individually, but also how we are together. I can't quite remember what I talked, I was thinking about this coming down on the train, what I talked about last night. I have a feeling it might have been the Sangraha Vastus. I think I might have talked about Sangharakshita as an exemplar of the Sangraha Vastus. The Sangraha Vastus is particularly taken up, it's an old teaching, you find it in the Pali texts, but it's taken up particularly by the Mahayana. Sangraha Vastu means, it's sometimes translated as the elements of conversion, but it's best described as the way in which a bodhisattva creates a spiritual community. So that's what bodhisattvas do. Somebody who's dedicated to gaining enlightenment for all beings. They know they can't do that all on their own. So they need to kind of bring people together. They need to gather a community to do the bodhisattva work together. And the Sangraha Vastus are one of the ways that that's described. So they are generosity, very obviously, that you gather people through being generous and encouraging generosity within the community. Sangharakshita Bhante once famously said, in talking about this, that the spiritual community should be characterised by the constant exchange of presents. Mm-hmm. Not just gifts, presents. Mm-hmm. So constantly giving to one another. This is the way you come together as a community. There's all sorts of things you can give to one another. Then there's loving speech, Priya Vadita, beautiful discussion, loving speech which it's not just, as he says, calling everybody dear and darling and so on. There's actually a bit of a joke here, because he said in this lecture on being all things to all men, he said that he was listening to a radio play, and in that radio play, a character was saying, "I'm going to kill you right now, darling." Right now, darling, just to say, became a bit of a thing in Croydon. When we were in the restaurant, if you wanted something quickly, you'd say, "Right now, darling." And then that became RND. So it's a little in-joke there. But anyway, no, it's not that. It's speech, it's communication, where you really are aware of the person you're talking to. And in another lecture, Bhante defines love, and he's talking about loving speech, as awareness of the being of another. Awareness of the being of another. Awareness of their full being, their full potential, their full presence. That's what loving speech really, really is. So obviously within a community that is so important, that we're speaking lovingly to one another, carefully to one another. It doesn't mean that you can't be direct, you can't be clear. It doesn't mean that you can't, on occasion point things out that you're finding difficult. But the overwhelming emphasis is on being really helpful and kindly to the people you're with, and making sure that your communication is enhancing their being. And then the third of the Sangraha Vastus is Artacharya, which is sort of means living meaningfully, living for the good. And that's explained in terms of communicating the Dharma, communicating the Buddha's teaching clearly, that making sure that within your Sangha, among one another and people coming, you're definitely communicating the Buddha's teaching. Don't let your Buddhist centre become... Punyamati said to me earlier, I think he was slightly joking, but you never know with Punyamati. He said, "I hope you're going to give a talk on Buddhism." I'm not on something else. And I said, well, do I speak about anything else? But really making sure that it's the Dharma that you communicate, which means you need to know the Dharma, study very deeply. And then the fourth Sangravastu is exemplification, Samanatata, which means, you know, you are exemplifying. Bhante made a beautiful point when he talked about this. You're not exemplifying an attainment, a fixed attainment. You said, but the path, that there is no such thing anyway. You're exemplifying your efforts to grow and develop along the path. And he said, if you exemplify that, actually, you're exemplifying the whole path to enlightenment. Wonderfully inspiring point. You often miss these little insights of Bhante because he says them so matter-of-factly. But if the Dharma life is continual growth and development towards enlightenment and even beyond, you could say, even our humble efforts to practice is exemplifying the whole thing. It's exemplifying that progressive conditionality, that movement in the direction of Buddhahood. So obviously we need to be doing that if we're going to communicate as a spiritual community. And I think in talking like this, I think you can see how much freedom will emerge if we're practicing like this. Freedom of movement between us through generosity and kindly speech. Freedom through communicating the Buddha's teaching. And that sense of freedom through living the Buddha's teaching fully, because it is a dynamic and unfolding path. Freedom is not allowing yourself to be stuck in a particular place. It's always this sense of flying beyond, you know, where you are, being one flight, as it were, above the given. So that's very briefly on the Sangravastus. But in talking about freedom and non-polarization, I wanted to talk about another teaching that's strongly related to these means of unification, the way in which a bodhisattva gathers a community. They're all part of what's called the bodhisattva's upaya kaushalya, his or her skillful means. This very skilled way of communicating the Dharma to people exactly where they are, according to what they exactly need. So this other teaching is called the Pratisamvit. It's a very underestimated teaching. Sorry to use all these, you know, Pali, Sanskrit words, but they're very hard to render properly into English. Pratisamvit actually could be literally translated as analytical knowledge, but that really doesn't do it justice. They're sort of wisdoms, really, or aspects of wisdom. They're the sort of wisdom aspect of the Bodhisattva's skillful means, the means of unification. The Sangravastus are the more compassionate, loving aspect. But this other side is the more wisdom aspect of the Bodhisattva's skill in communication. One of the things that when Bhante's talked about skillful means, he said it is something, though, that is very natural. The Bodhisattva's skillful means isn't a sort of technique, a sort of how to win friends and influence people technique. It's coming out of a deep vision and practice of the Dharma life and a deep engagement with others. These teachings are just ways in which the Buddha and Buddhist tradition have sort of tried to kind of notice what we need to be aware of in order to bring this about. So I want to have a go at expounding these Pratisamvits. It's not easy because, you know, I think they represent a very profound realization, but nonetheless they're important, and I think they do shed light on this business of being free, liberated from polarization, and communicating in a way that brings everybody potentially onto the path. And creating a deeper sense of community. So the four Pratisamvits are, first of all, Dharma Pratisamvit, knowledge or wisdom of reality, let's call it that. Then there's Artha Pratisamvid, which is wisdom or knowledge of meaning. Then there's Nirukti Pratisamvid, which is knowledge or wisdom of etymology. Sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? But you'll see why. And then there's finally Pratibhana Pratisamvid, which is wisdom of courage. So the wisdom of courage. So let's just go through these and see what we can get out of them. So first of all, Dharma Pratisamvid, knowledge or analytical knowledge or wisdom of reality. So the way this is explained is this is a direct, unmediated realization of the way things are, of the way things are, not through ideas. So we're talking at a very, very high level. It's that wisdom, that insight into the nature of reality. Dharma here means reality, the truth, things as they are, but non-conceptually. No ideas being involved here. It's the wisdom beyond words, a direct vision of things. So what on earth do you say about that? Fortunately, Bhante kind of gave some hints. He referred to what's called the Dashabhumika Sutra, a very important Mahayana Sutra about the 10 stages of the Bodhisattva path, where it talks about what this wisdom of reality means, does unfold it a bit. And the Dashabhumika Sutra, like the Lotus Sutra, is very concerned with the Ekayana, the one way to reality, not one in the numerical sense, it's one in the transcendent sense. So this wisdom of the Dharma is seeing directly, not as an idea, not as a dogma, that all the Dharma paths, all the different ways in which you practice, all lead in the direction of reality, in the direction of liberation. You know, this is the big theme of the Lotus Sutra, if you've studied that, the Shravakayana, the Pratyeka Buddhayana, they all, the Mahayana, the Bodhisattvayana, they are all concerned with the full realization of Buddhahood. They are all about becoming Buddhas. So a Bodhisattva is someone who knows this as a reality. They know, they've got this sense that all, you know, this direct knowledge, this intuition, this direct seeing, that all Dharma practice, all Dharma teaching is about one thing. It's about the movement and the liberation of the individual towards enlightenment. Now, this might sound, you know, sort of obvious, but it's not, actually, as a realization. On our retreat, we had that beautiful parable of the rain cloud from the White Lotus Sutra. It's so beautiful. We read the version from that Bhante uses in his lectures on the lotus. It's so beautiful. It's an old translation by Suthil. And, of course, Bhante read this when he was undergoing an operation in the 1980s before he was knocked out, because he was, you know, concerned that he might not get through this operation. And it was very interesting how he did to prepare. He did the refuges and precepts, he did some mantras, he read the rain cloud, and then he did the order metta bhavana. He did metta for all order members throughout the world. But it's this business of the rain cloud, it's this image of this great cloud in the hot season in India, at the end of the hot season, rising up, you know, bringing shade, and then this one rain, as the Buddha calls it, this one rain of the Dharma falling on all beings, just like the rain falls on all the different kinds of shrubs and flowers and plants. Everything grows individually, uniquely, but they're refreshed by that one rain. So the Buddha is saying, in the same way, that's what I do. There are all these different kinds of people. They mean all sorts of different things. But behind it all is one teaching, one dharma, if you like, which is concerned with the liberation. You need this as a realization. I mean, it's sort of shameful sometimes the way in which people sort of polarize about dharma practices or dharma insights. It's really kind of peculiar. Strangely as well, people seem to get more dogmatic if they claim an insight or an attainment. They seem to get very dogmatic about what they've seen. This is the one way, and there is no other. Well, it's not like that. There are all sorts of different ways, because there are so many different kinds of people, and we have so many different faculties which need educating and developing. But yes, the Dharma is one, but it manifests in all sorts of different ways. And this is a very, very strong instinct in Bhante, in the way he set up our order and movement. He has a deep feeling for, if you like, the variety, the range of Buddhist practice, but it must be coming out of that deep vision of the one Dharma. And as I say, it's a transcendent one, it's a deep one, if you like. Very, very interesting, and it happens on all kinds of levels with him. You can see it in terms of him identifying the going for refuge as the centre of the Dharma life. The act of commitment is so important. There's one act of commitment, going for refuge. That will have different expressions at different times in Buddhist history, which are very, very important. But it's about identifying that act of commitment in the going for refuge. His conviction that, the Buddhism of the Pali Canon, with its strong emphasis on self-motivation and so on, that's absolutely crucial. And yet he's a man that can see no conflict between that and other power in the East Asian tradition of the Pure Land. There's actually no conflict between those things, because he has this deep realization of the one Dharma. So one of the things we've got to be doing when we're practicing together, studying together, talking the Dharma together, communicating the Dharma, we need to identify in any teaching that we're looking at, what is it doing? What is it doing? What's it for? How is this concerned with the liberation of the individual unto full Buddhahood? That's what we need to be identifying with, and not getting hooked up on this technique or this practice or this dogma or this doctrine. We need to have a deep feeling for the underlying transcendent vision of the Dharma. So that's the first of the pratisamvids, and it should strongly inform our centre. We should have a strong sense of all of our practices and teachings being concerned with the liberation of the individual. It's very, very good that we have the Buddha on the shrine and not another figure, if you like. We can have other figures as well, but it's about Buddhahood in the end. It's about that realisation. Then there's Artha Pratisamvid. This is very, very interesting, Artha Pratisamvid, because this is wisdom of meaning, and it's what this is described as. It's the way in which that realisation of the one Dharma, which you can't express in any particular words, the way it is expressed in principles. So this is what's particularly about the wisdom of the Artha Pratisamvid, is aware in which the way in which the Buddha and the great teachers in Buddhist tradition, the way they've articulated their realization. So in other words, it's having a real wisdom, knowledge, understanding of what, if you like, Buddhist doctrine. So the Pratichasamutpada, cyclic links, progressive links, the three lakshanas, the four noble truths, the Eightfold Path, you know, all of those different things, five spiritual faculties, the different sort of practices that bring these about. You need, if you like, not just a good, clear knowledge of those things, but you need to see how they are expressing that vision of the Dharma. And it's very, very important, you know, to do that. Sometimes I know people don't always get on with Buddhist lists and Buddhist doctrine. Sometimes I think people can be almost a bit scared of them in terms of understanding them and learning them and using them. But if you have a sense of always asking yourself, what's this teaching for? How does this teaching bring about that movement in the direction of Buddhahood? It will change your perspective on that particular teaching. And notice, I said a number of things. I mentioned a number of different teachings from Buddhist tradition. Not just one. Sometimes people get very narrow in their decisions about what they emphasise. So sometimes, you know, people will just tell you, it's all about non-self. That's what you've got to realise, as if there's no other teaching. Well, that's nonsense. That's one of the lachas. It's one of the lachas. There's also impermanence. There's also dukkha. There's also ashubha. And there's also the reflection on their correspondences in nirvana, the gateways to liberation. There's also pratichasamutpada. So to reduce the Buddha's teaching to one thing, just one word, is very dangerous, I think, and it usually ends up with sort of Buddhist fundamentalism, a kind of Buddhist fundamentalism. There are versions of Buddhist fundamentalism, and there isn't that flexibility in relation to the teaching, because you're not intuiting what the Dharma is really for. The Buddha described the path, he described even reality in so many different ways in order to, you know, for us, so that we can be flexible and responsive and gain more of a sort of sense of what that one Dharma is really like. As I said, it's a transcendent one, not a numerical one. I remember once Bhante, I think it's in the Three Jewels, he says our attitude to Buddhist doctrine shouldn't be to approach it like dogmatic theology. It's more that they're like different coloured balls that you're juggling with. So you're playing with the teaching, if you like. Yes, you need to develop a very strong conviction and understanding of it, but playfully. Always be playful with it, especially when you're discussing it. Otherwise you trap yourself in literalism, becoming very, very literal-minded. You know, when the Buddha taught, he always taught specifically. Very important when you look at the teaching of the Buddha or any of the great teachers, they're talking to someone. It's a response to a particular set of circumstances. It's for them. So yes, there's doctrine, there's Buddhist doctrine, but it's taught in this at this time, at this moment, for a particular reason. It's not like a sort of dogma that you should sort of tick off. Oh, I've got that. I understand that for all time. So Artha Pratisamvi, very, very important to really know your Buddhist doctrine. And of course, you're knowing it in order to turning it into a living experience. One of the things that is so important to get hold of as a Buddhist practitioner, that the Buddha's words, the Buddha's teaching, he regards as the best way in which we can intuit that transcendent wordless Dharma. The teachings are not arbitrary. You know, sometimes you get this, you might have come across the distinction between the so-called absolute truth and the relative truth, the truth of ultimate meaning and the truth of conventional meaning. And of course, highly ambitious Westerners and even highly ambitious Easterners, oh, I'm up for the absolute. I'm not interested in the conventional. Absolute higher, conventional lower. I'm not with the plebs. I'm for the absolute. I'm for, you know, emptiness, not self. You know, pure consciousness, Buddha already, I'm not interested in, you know, all that other stuff. But it's not arbitrary. The Buddha wants to introduce you to that ultimate teaching, and he does that by using particular ideas and principles, which you then need to reflect on, you know, make and turn into a living experience. When it becomes a living experience, you don't need to keep it as a set of ideas in your mind. You might use those ideas to communicate to others, but first you've really got to engage in the sort of grit of those teachings. Just take a teaching like conditioned co-production. This being, that becomes, on the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become, on the ceasing of this, that ceases. Well, you know, sounds quite straightforward as a teaching. If you start reflecting on that and you realise that it applies to absolutely all experience, you begin to get a little glimpse of, oh, actually, the truth of this cannot be held in any idea, even this idea. This idea is useful because I'm learning to see how my actions have consequences, how they affect myself and other people and so on and so forth. So you start to see that, you know, more and more clearly, but it becomes more and more of a living experience. So you don't have to keep it in your mind, as Bhante comments on the saying, the Tathagata has no views. The Tathagata, the Buddha, doesn't have any views. He says, when all the answers are in your being, there's no need to keep them in your head. But, you know, if they're not in your being, you do need to keep them in your head. So, yes, that's Artha Pratisamvid, the wisdom of really knowing how to work with and use Buddhist teaching. So that needs to be part of our Sangha, of our community. We need to go more and more deeply into that, study it, reflect on it, make it a living experience. And of course, the more we do that, the more we can communicate the Dharma reflectively to others coming along, which brings us to Nirukti Pratisamvid, analytical knowledge of etymology. Sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? Etymology. Very Indian, in a sense, concern. You know, sort of high watermark of Indian sort of scholasticism, but it's not really to do with that. It's you need to know the words, the best words, the right words, the most accurate words to communicate the teaching, to get across the doctrine, to get across that wordless teaching. You need to use the most accurate words that you can find to point to that teaching. So knowing what words mean is very important. One of the things, and this brings us to communication, one of the things that Bhante is very keen on was that saying of Confucius, when Confucius was asked, what would you do to reform the state, the country? His first thing was rectification of terms. Rectification of terms. We need to define our words. So often there's so much miscommunication, so much polarisation, because people are talking at cross purposes. I have a particular understanding of a word. You hear that word, and it has all sorts of reactions to you. It's not what I intend, but it has that sort of sense for you. So if we're starting to polarise, we have to sit down and say, what do you mean by that word? What do I mean by that word? Let's try and work out what the meanings of our terms are. Very, very important in communication with one another. So much room for misunderstanding, because there just isn't that common understanding of the language that we're employing, that we're using. So we need to use the right words with one another, and need to be sensitive, you know, to language when we're communicating the Dharma to other people. Of course, sometimes the way you're using a word and the doctrine you're expressing is exactly what you mean, and the person has a reaction to it, but you can't change it. You can't sort of dress it up and say it's not like that. You know, if you're putting forward a sort of dharmic point, you know, to take a sort of extreme example that, you know, Buddhism says everything is profoundly impermanent. There is nothing substantial anywhere in existence. And somebody says, well, I don't agree. I think there is. There is something substantial. I want there to be something substantial. Could you put this in another way? And say, well, not really. You can't really do that. You could go into asking them, well, what kind of substantiality are you looking for? All that sort of thing. But, you know, you need to really define your terms and make sure that you're talking at the same on the same wavelength. I also think that Nirukti, what it's referring to, another aspect to it, is it's very important that when you communicate the Dharma, and even when you think about the Dharma in your own mind, that it is full of beauty. It's not just clear, but it's lovely. It's adorned. I think this is very, very important when we think about the Dharma in our own minds and when we're communicating the Dharma to others. It's so important in Buddhist tradition, you know, that, you know, in the training of the Bodhisattva training as it develops in the monastic communities especially, there's an enormous amount of emphasis on learning poetry, learning rhetoric, learning how to communicate as vividly as possible, you know, really evoking the Dharma in the richest possible way for people. I feel very uncomfortable sometimes when somebody's talking about, say, their meditation practice or even their sort of so-called insights into things. It's so boring. It's so boring. It's so dry. And you think, really? Really? That's seeing things as they are? You know, there's no sort of thrill. There's no ecstasy. There's no inspiration. It's sort of like, well, it's like describing how, you know, a car, it's like a car manual or something like that. And then we think, no, I don't believe that. I don't believe it could be like that. Surely if you've really seen the way things are, there'd be a thrill in the way you talk, in the way you communicate. You will burst into poetry. This wonderful disciple of the Buddha named Vangisa, where he praises, but he was a poet, Vangisa. Vangisa means Lord of Speech. And Vangisa was praising the Buddha's Amitavacca, his deathless speech, deathless speech, deathless voice. Well, that must be because the Buddha is not just communicating the words, you know, just in sort of technically, but there's a thrill in the communication, a thrill in the language that he's using, where people have a sort of sense of the deathless, the sense of something beyond. You know, he's coming out of that deathless state. There's another lovely, very short sutta where this old man goes to see the Buddha, an old disciple of the Buddha, and the Buddha says, oh, we haven't seen you for such a long time. He said, no, Bhante, I've not been well, and So I haven't been able to see you. And he said, oh, it's so good to see you. And they have a very, very short communication. And this old man leaves, and it's all about all the Buddha says. Yes, getting old is difficult. Getting old is difficult. And don't some of us know it? Getting old is difficult. This is the way of things. That's all the Buddha says, but there's something in his voice, something in his speech, something in the reality of his communication, where this man, he leaves, and Sariputta sees him, and he says, you look radiant. What's happened? And he says, I've been to see the Tathagata, I've been to see the Buddha, and I feel sprinkled with the deathless. Sprinkled with the deathless. And it's the Pali word for adhisthana. Blessed with the deathless, just in that communication. So we need something of that with one another. and with people coming in off the street. Coming out of our depth of study, of practice, of intuiting the Dharma, so that when people come in, they feel that nectar of the deathless through the words that we use, through the whole sort of feeling that we have. And I know that people do feel that. So many people say when they, you know, sometimes on their first time in a Buddhist centre, that they felt their life changing. They might not have used the language of being sprinkled by the deathless, but something happened which changed their life. And that brings us to the last of the prasangik, which is analytical knowledge of courage, pratibhana, pratisamvid. So this is, pratibhana can also mean ready speech. It means courage, ready speech, wit, quick-wittedness. So it's you don't just have the words, you have the exact words at the right time for that person in that moment. You can just say it and it has the effect that's needed. I mean, so often, I don't know about you, I always afterwards seeing someone or even giving a talk, oh, I wish I'd said that. That would have been the thing to say at that moment. But we learn. And sometimes perhaps we don't even know if we've said the very word that's needed. Perhaps it's one of those things, it's better not to be that self-conscious about, oh, I've got to find the right word for this person to, you know, perhaps that isn't it. It's more that you are so deeply absorbed in the Dharma life, so deeply absorbed in that, so much a part of sharing the Dharma life with others, that when you meet people, you do say the right thing. You do say exactly what is needed, and quite unselfconsciously for them, give them the teaching that they actually need. And you're not even self-conscious of giving a teaching. It's awful if people are self-consciously giving teachings. It's the last thing you want. But I've been quite shocked sometimes when people have said to me, do you remember that time you said such and such to me on this retreat? And I thought, crikey, that sounds amazing. I have no memory of saying it whatsoever. And I thought, wow, oh, yes, very good. But I'm sure you've had a similar experience in all sorts of walks of life. You have said the right thing at the right time, or it might not just be what you've said. It could be the right gesture, you know, just putting your arm around somebody, or just holding their hand, or just listening. Sometimes just listening is all that's needed. That's the right thing to say, not to say anything, just to really hear what's going on with the other person. So I hope that gives you some sort of sense of the pratisamvid. If you want to follow this up, listen to Bhante's lecture on being all things to all men in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha series, because that's just such a wonderful lecture where he really tries to unpack the nature of skillful means, the nature of communicating the Dharma in exactly the way that people need it at any given time. And we can't do that on our own. We need to be part of a community to do that. Because what people need, more than anything, is a very, very positive sense of community. So it's another way in which you communicate. You know, when people see people in friendship and harmony with one another, it's deeply attractive. I remember years ago on a seminar, people were asking Bhante about insight and all this sort of, you know, attainment. And the way he answered was really interesting. He said, I get a lot of letters from people really, really thanking me for starting that. And so he's not answering the question directly, apparently. And he said, then they say they came to the centre or the retreat and the teaching was really good and really clear and the meditation was really good, but what made the difference was saying the way in which the people running the centre of the class, the way they were in harmony with each other. That's what they really liked. The fact that they were enjoying being with one another, enjoying running the centre, enjoying doing the class, that nothing was too much trouble. He said that really pleases me to hear that. And it was pretty obvious what he was saying, that's the real sign of any serious growth, when you have that mutuality of love within the community. Yes, all the clarity, all the depth, you've got to have all that, but that is manifesting as this deep love and sharing, you know, with one another, and wanting to share that with people coming in. That's what people, you know, really need. And I, you know, since Banti died, it's been people often ask me, well, how is it for you since Banti died? Because you've known him since you were 17. He's my teacher, my beloved teacher. And, you know, are you grieving? And there's no grief, nothing like that. There's no grief, because in some ways he hasn't gone away. In some ways he has, in some ways he hasn't. What there has been some intense, you know, crying. But I realised recently it's gratitude. It's just intense feelings of gratitude, if you can have intense gratitude, that such an amazing man, a really truly amazing man, showed an interest in me from a young age, gave me the Dharma very, very purely and directly, gave me enormous encouragement without asking for anything in return. Just gave me that. It gave me the possibility of being part of this community with so many friendships and so much richness, increasing richness, and the possibility of leading a fully meaningful life. And the other day I was meditating on Padmasambhava, who in some ways can be described as one of the figures that particularly embodies skillful means, teaching the Dharma exactly as people need it. And I was concluding my meditation and I was reflecting on Bhante, and I was reflecting on what he'd given me. Mindfulness of breathing, yes, I need that. Metta Bhavana, yes, I need that. Meditation on the elements and shunyata, yes, I need that. Visualization practice, yes, I need that. Puja, yes, I need that. Chapter meetings, yes, I need that. Going for refuge in the precepts, yes, I need that. I was just going through all these things that he'd actually given me, either directly or indirectly, which are precisely what I need. We'll never stop needing, and we'll never stop going into. And you realise that you've been given what you need by someone, there's nothing but gratitude and you know, the concern as well to keep sharing that as fully as possible. And yes, I do believe if we practice like this, if we live the Dharma like this, we will have an offering to make to this polarised and polarising world. It's very, very difficult, you know, what's going on in the world. It does seem so awful at times. And yes, there's a lot of wonderful things as well. And sometimes we can feel that what we're doing is so small, so tiny in relation to it all. But that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. So long as there's a place, there's a light shining, there's an island standing somewhere that's keeping something open, that's keeping that one Dharma, that Ekayana open, that's all that matters. Yes, we can do more. Maybe we could do a lot more. But let's keep the door to the deathless open as much as possible. That is a real offering to this polarised world.
Thank you so much, Padmavajra. I think the thrill and the beauty of the Dharma has just flowed through you. It's just a privilege to hear you and to have you here.
Thank you.